to be a good one. My special guest is Frances Martell. She is the international editor for Breitbart News. Let me tell you a little bit about her, and then I'll let you meet her yourself. Her expertise is Latin America, China, Africa, and the Middle East, also religious persecution globally. Spanish is her first language, and she reads and understands Portuguese. Let me share with you Breitbart News' official bio for Frances. It was while working for Mediaite that Martell had her first interaction with Andrew Breitbart. It was hard to keep up with Andrew's brain. He was rapid fire. He hated elitism, hated the idea of an ivory tower of rich white liberals telling the rest of us what to believe. Martell says, I clicked with that. It clicked for her so much that in 2013, she joined Breitbart News Network as a freelancer and quickly rose through the ranks, becoming its international editor. Martell draws on her family history to infuse her writing with a uniquely personal perspective. Her writing has been cited across the political spectrum, from Rush Limbaugh to Lawrence O'Donnell. That's Frances Martell. That's a little bit about Frances Martell. You'll get to find out a whole lot more right now. So here we go. Frances, welcome to the Adrienne Ross Show. I'm glad you are on with me today.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. We've been working together for almost a decade now. So
it's actually, not a full decade. It's over 10 years from my calculation. Yeah. And so as long as we work together, we don't get to we've never had an opportunity to communicate like this. And so I'm really excited to be able to have this kind of combo. All the interaction is over the internet and I do pick your brain, but never like I'm about to pick your brain right now. So I'm really, really excited. Now, I know that you have a wealth of knowledge, which we see in your writing, in your appearances on Breitbart News Daily. And I did share your bio as the international editor for the prestigious Breitbart News outlet. But I did not share this, and I want to start with this, and I want to let this be the jumping off point for where we have our conversation.
Okay,
you said, I'm anti-communist. As a poor Hispanic child of Cuban refugees, my family stories were about the communists stripping my grandparents of everything, their business, their possessions. Communism for them meant years in labor camps, and it still means the trauma, the PTSD that lingers. And I wanted to start there because although I am going to pick your brain about what's going on around the world, you have an interesting story. And that quote really packs a punch. And so what I want to know is, I want to know about your upbringing. You talk about, you were born here. You're in New Jersey, right? You were raised, you said, by refugees.
Yes.
Your grandparents suffered under communism. And so I want you to tell a little bit of that story. I'm sure as you've heard many stories throughout your life. And I really want to know, how did that play into your upbringing? So talk to us.
Absolutely. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity because I don't really believe in objective journalism. You have to look at who's telling the story to decide whether, you know, how much you trust the story, right? So I want people who read me to know who I am and where I'm coming from. And so where I come from is New Jersey. I was born in Hoboken, same as Frank Sinatra. and when I was born there, it was not, you know, today Hoboken is a glitzy, like gentrified place. Back then it was pretty poor. And my family lived in Union City in North Bergen, which is where the heart of the Cuban community in New Jersey is. And it still is. It's the second most Cuban populated place after Miami. So my parents came here with their parents. My dad was 14. My mom was 16. They met here, but they both experienced, they're from the same town. They experienced the same thing where they were born in the 50s. My dad was born a month before the revolution. My mom was born in 53. So my mom has some memories of pre-revolutionary Cuba. My dad does not. And they were very much victimized, and my grandparents too. My paternal grandfather had a bike shop that he kind of built on his own, you know, buying gear by gear. He built his first bike, rented it out to the tourists to drive to the beach. with that money, he, you know, made, he bought a second bike and a third bike. And by the time he had kids, he had a bike shop. And then, you know, that became the people's bike shop, was taken away from him. And he and my grandmother were sent to, quote unquote, voluntary labor, which is where they put you in a labor camp to do agricultural work for several years. And they had to do that work if they wanted to get out. And so that's how they got out. On my mom's side, as far as I know, there weren't any camps or anything because they were poor. They didn't have anything to take from them. But it was very much a struggle to get out. You had to find cousins somewhere that would vouch for you, get to Florida. And there's a lot of trauma that is unresolved in our community because they came here. They're clearly pro-American. They've always, you know, there's always been a warm relationship between Cuba and America from independence. But they don't speak English. They don't know how this system works. They have no idea what it's like to pay rent, get a job, what a credit card is for. And so there's just years upon years of trauma and a lot of stuff I grew up with that is not normal. And I only realize that now as an adult. For example, my birthday parties, when I was a little kid, the guests were these like grizzled ex-political prisoners, you know, that would sit around playing chess and telling war stories about, you know, how they got arrested for defying Fidel or, you know, fantasizing about, you know, invading again and, you know, cursing John F. Kennedy for Bay of Pigs. And that, you know, now I realize that's not everybody's kid birthday party.
Right?
It's not normal. And so it was a very heavily politicized atmosphere growing up, but, you know, it made me realize that I have a role to play in preserving our freedom in telling this story so it doesn't just get swept under the rug and future generations make the same mistakes, and to just honor the sacrifices that they made so that I could have a relatively normal upbringing. Like, we were poor, but there was food in the fridge. You know, I got a public school education, which was, you know, better than reciting Che Guevara's journal writings to become literate. I have a lot of opportunities that happened because a lot of people made really difficult choices and they still live with the shock of making those choices.
And as a parent, though, how do you bring all of that to your children? Or do you? I know your children are young.
Yeah.
So how does that all play into how you raise them and how you teach them and the language you speak at home, all of it?
So my husband is not Cuban. My husband is a Jersey guy, you know, American for like 10 generations, does not have this kind of baggage, right? So we don't speak Spanish at home usually. We try to introduce it as much as we can. I want them to be fluent. My mom's often around. They talk to her. And I'm very overtly political with my kids. You know, my oldest, who's 5, I've talked to her about communism, very sort of, you know, in the most basic way possible, but saying, you know, there are people who want to have power over you and your family and your things, and they use the government to try to amass this power and then abuse you. And you have to be aware of that. And, you know, when you hear people talking about free stuff, giving you more things, bigger government, you have to be careful because these are the same people that did these horrible things to your parents and grandparents. And I know it's early. Very early. But, you know, she knows who like George Washington is. She has a vague understanding of being an American. So you also have to introduce this legacy that she has. And eventually they're both going to have to learn. They have a responsibility as the beneficiaries of these sacrifices that these Cuban refugees made to keep telling those stories and to help guide the ship, you know, to navigate this ship that is America in the little way that every American does.
Mm-hmm. Wow, let's talk about immigration, because that is such, it's huge right now. Obviously, it was a huge part of the State of the Union address with President Biden using the term illegals, which he's not allowed to use, and then backtracking for, you know, to undocumented people. I'm going to imagine that you have perhaps a unique perspective on immigration, illegal immigration, legal immigration. What are your thoughts about what's going on right now at the border?
Sure. I mean, my biggest concern with the way things are done at the border is that it's a tremendous disservice to people who want to be Americans for the right reasons, right? Who want to come here because they know that we have certain values and that we respect human dignity in a way that their home countries do not. And so these are people who, if given a legal avenue, would take it. But the bureaucracy is so broken down that it takes years to get any sort of hearing. The easiest way to do it is to pay drug cartels that do human trafficking, and to suffer atrocities. There's so many people that come here, especially women, who have to take these routes up the Darien Gap, to get out of Venezuela, which is a socialist dictatorship allied with Hezbollah, so they these people are there's a tremendous disservice to these people. And there's also the concern that they are getting elbowed out of the way, even out of that worse route, right? Which is the northern route with the cartels. They're getting elbowed out of the way by gang members from groups like El Tren de Aragua, which the Venezuelan government essentially allowed a massive jailbreak of these gangsters. And now they're taking the routes up, and they're taking up space that should be going to legitimate, refugees, basically. And they're abusing that, and they're coming up. And then there's no bureaucracy for processing these people, for figuring out who they are, for trying to assimilate them. Because once you get into America, America is a very difficult place to assimilate into. Being an American requires a lot of responsibilities. It takes a lot of hard work individually. It takes understanding these elaborate systems. I mean, again, a credit card is so difficult to understand if you're coming from a communist country. And so we do a tremendous disservice to these people. And by doing so, we're also hurting the Americans that are here, because we're not protecting them, and we're not protecting their both their economic necessities, but also just from national security reasons. Again, we don't know who's coming up. So I just My problem with the system now is that it's a disservice to everybody. I'm not taking sides, like, native born American versus immigrant. I just think everyone is being hurt right now.
Yeah. I've said before, I wouldn't want to be among those who had to fix the problem. Because I don't, I you know what I mean? I like you said, it's a difficult situation, and I don't envy that at all. But I know what I see right now. Is it working? You know, it's not working. Okay, so going back to your upbringing, a friend of mine teaches, you mentioned Florida. Friend of mine teaches in Florida at a charter school. And so she teaches a lot of Cuban students. She teaches Haitian students. She's got Jamaican students. She's got all these students. And so she said that they had this conversation, and these students were saying, many of them, she said the Cuban students, not so much, but some also have this mindset that they don't identify as Americans. They don't, I mean, they're here. They're obviously their parents are here, but they don't have that identity as Americans. And so I want you to hold on to that thought. And then also I want to show you a clip, part of something I started with the show, I think in the fall with the Adrian Ross Show, is something I call Taking It to the Streets. And I went to the Southeast Missouri State University. We call it SEMO. And I wanted to ask people, when you hear the term American, what comes to your mind? And so I want to show you this exchange with a young man, and then I want to get your feedback on that, as well as what I just shared with you about my friend and her students.
All right, so for the record, this young man does not go to school here, but he's waiting for his girlfriend who does. But I'm going to ask him some questions anyway for the Adrian Ross Show. What does it mean to you to be an American?
To be an American.
Yeah.
Well, I came from like an immigrant home, so I'm a first generation immigrant. My whole family is Bosnian, but I grew up here.
Okay.
So it's like I kind of grew up with like, don't be American, but be American at the same time. So like, I just think anyone can be American as long as like you embody, I guess, sort of a pride for your country.
So elaborate a little bit about when your family said, don't be an American, but be an American. How do you balance that?
Well, it was like it was just weird when I was young at school because like, I kind of got treated like I was everybody else because, when you go to school, but kids are also different. So like I got treated a little differently, but the same by like teachers and stuff. And so like it was just kind of like slowly everyone else at my school specifically was also like I had a lot of Bosnians, a lot of Hispanic people, like everyone kind of connected being different, which was nice. But with that home, my mom was kind of like, I don't know, this is especially true, I think, for a lot of like Bosnian immigrants. They kind of like push away a lot of American like norms and kind of try to like stick to themselves, you know what I mean? So like since I grew up here, I kind of feel like I am American. I guess like the Bosnian American is like the right term. But yeah, just
Holding to the traditions as well. But what
Okay, so you heard what he said, and you also heard what I said about my friend's students. How do you relate to that? Does that resonate with you? American, but don't be American. What are your thoughts about what was said?
Well, I think there's sort of, they're talking about two different things and mixing them together. There's the political identity of being an American, which has to do with the way our democracy works, our republic, you know, before anyone argues that, you know, we're not really a democracy, or the way our republic works, our Bill of Rights, our respect for human rights, the values that we represent on the world stage. And then there's this idea of being culturally American. And for us, for Cubans, we'll say Los Americanos, and we're talking about like white Anglo-Americans, right? Like white Anglo-Protestant Americans. And they have a culture that's very deeply rooted in the United States, and it's very different from ours. And so we totally embrace the you know, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, like try to get into politics as much as possible. I mean, look at Congress, look at how many Cubans are in Congress versus how many Cubans are in America. And it's because we really relish that opportunity to be part of the political system. But if you tell us not to be loud or dance salsa, not to like roast a pig on Christmas, we're gonna be a little, you know, put off by that, because that's also part of our identity. But it's not, it has nothing to do with how we view the political system. We're not coming here to make America more like Cuba politically. But you know, if we could bring our food, our music, our values, you know, our sort of religious values, not necessarily like our political ones, because those are the ones we share with the US, right? But I think sometimes there's a little bit of pressure, and I married into, you know, a white American family, so sometimes I see the way they behave. I see they're kind of quiet at holidays, and they listen to different music than me, and they have different favorite movies and stuff. And you do feel, as a member of a community that is not the dominant culture, that you don't want your culture to be erased. You don't want that to be a memory. The Christmas parties from when you were a kid, again, the music, the art, the people that you grew up hearing about who are like the Cuban founding fathers, the poets that had actually really close bonds to the United States. You don't want to lose that. And so it is a balancing act, but the way I see it is what makes me American is political, and what makes me Cuban is ethnic, and it's cultural, and it's my bloodline straight back to, you know, Spain, Africa, and Native Americans. And that has nothing to do with whether I embrace the structure of the American political system.
Okay, so let's transition to your work at Breitbart. Your background is in law, right? You've been you were you went to Harvard, and you went to Fordham. Was it how? What's the name of it? Fordham
Court
School
of
of Law,
law.
Fordham Law. And now you are the international editor for Breitbart News. So how that transition?
Well, I graduated from Harvard class of 2009, so I graduated into like the worst economy possible. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to do something with politics and something with writing, because those were always my strong suits since I was little. And of course, I had a lot of pressure from the family to be politically active in some way, because that's what the grandparents tell you. If you're not active, the communists are going to be active, and the same thing's going to happen to your kids that happened to your grandparents. So I knew I wanted to be political, but I didn't know how. And law school is only 3 years. You know, I didn't want to go into a 6 or 7 year PhD program for no reason. But I didn't want to practice law either, and I've never practiced law. The things that I was most interested in law school were international law, things like the definition of genocide, the processing human rights criminals through international courts, terrorism law. That was kind of what I gravitated towards. And then I had a weird aside where I took a class on natural law, which is all Catholic religion, basically. And I loved that too. But that informed me and enriched me as a person. It didn't really give me a career direction. Right. Right. So I just happened to be very lucky that when I graduated law school, I knew people who knew people who were at Breitbart, and I didn't really have anywhere to go. I had worked at Mediaite, which is a website that basically watches cable news so you don't have to. And yeah. I've never watched cable news again. I did it professionally and I'm done.
Yeah.
And so I had that background, and I ended up just having a very good friend who connected me, and I found my home, and I just felt like I found a place where people got me, where it was like a weird collective of people that I didn't totally agree or disagree with, but they accepted me. And when I talked to them, I felt smarter. Mm-hmm. And I stayed. And that was 10 years ago.
Exactly. Well, I'd like to think the more people I talk to, the smarter I get, but I'm not sure.
Depends on the people. I know I get smarter when I talk to you. So I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here, because this is the deal. I wanted you here because I'm not so smart on these issues, these world affair issues. And I'm going to pick your brain about some of these things. I know that you're covering what's going on, Russia, Africa, China, North Korea, El Salvador, Venezuela, et cetera. We can't get into all that today, but you're covering all that stuff. And then when I talk to you, I'm like, your way of communicating certain things, it's like, it's not just something that you see on the news or hear in the news. It brings life to it. And for me to get interested in it, then you're doing a good job in your writing, because this stuff is like, I'm totally clueless about this stuff, but I wanted to get your take because you're not clueless. And so I get to learn and the audience gets to learn. But before I ask you about any of these world leaders, any of these countries, I have to say this. There are people who are about as clueless as I am, perhaps, or not, but they don't get why world affairs, international affairs, why that's important to Americans. And that's what I want to ask you. Like, why should we care? And you obviously believe we do. This is your work. This is what you're doing. Obviously, this is something Breitbart is committed to. Why should we as Americans be concerned about what's happening in El Salvador or Argentina or Russia or anywhere?
Well, there's two big reasons for this. So the first one is one that is very translates very well into your personal life. Why should you care about the way other people run their lives, how they commit to their lives? And the answer is, you want to learn from other people's mistakes. You want to see how other things work out for other people and see if that might work out for you or not. And every country is its own little political experiment, right? And in a lot of cases, almost overtly so. Like, there are places where it honestly feels like things are being implemented over there to see if they can try them over here. Brazil is the example I'm thinking of, where there's just this huge Supreme Court overreach constantly to silence conservative dissent. It is working partially, and I do think that if it works over there, they're going to try it over here. So that's reason number one. We want to see what's going on in other countries and see what works and what doesn't, and see what we can fix regarding what other people are doing and what we really need to avoid. And the other one is simply that America is a unique country in that both geographically, we're kind of in the middle of everyone, right? And culturally, we are impacted by everything that goes on in the world, and we impact everything that goes on in the world. And that's both political and cultural. There are things politically that happen here where other countries look and say, oh, that worked out for America. Maybe we'll implement it. Or dictators will see that something happens here and they'll pass preventative laws to, you know, to prevent a certain level of dissent, or, you know, they think that a certain political cultural movement is especially effective and they'll try to shut it down. So we are constantly in this conversation with the rest of the world where what happens in other countries affects us. And it affects us through kind of cultural osmosis and things like, you know, transnational drug trades that are, you know, the end game of every illegal operation is to operate here because here's where the money is. And other countries simply want to use us to elevate their influence. And that's a problem too. And sometimes it's not a problem. Sometimes it's a friend of ours, you know, a country like Israel who uses us, that we have their back, and then they can work better to prevent, you know, acts of terrorism. It's not always bad, but right. We are always in that conversation with the rest of the world.
Have we lost the respect on the world stage that we once had? What are your thoughts on that? I think you hear that a lot, whether it's because of President Biden or Trump or former President Trump. Is America still the standard of the
yes,
world?
I mean, the answer is who else is the standard? You know, I'm sure there's some troll out there will say, well, Hungary or El Salvador is the standard. And that's obviously not true. Like, we still are the standard. I do think that we have lost the respect of Western Europe. And the way that we are educated in this country is, you know, America won World War II, and everyone loves us because we won World War II. We defeated the Nazis, and we've always had this tremendous amount of respect. And now we don't have it. And that eliminates, there's so many countries that are not part of that, right? Like, that doesn't take into account, you know, but China never quite had, you know, we had a moderately friendly relationship with them before communism, but it's not like, you know, we've lost the respect of China. Like, that's not, and that's a major country. Same with Brazil, which is another, you know, huge country. Countries like Nigeria, and I'm just picking the biggest countries in their respective regions. I don't think we have, I think we're about where we always were, but we have lost the respect of France and Germany and, you know, probably the Netherlands. And honestly, I would say who cares? It's 2024. These countries are not as important as countries like Colombia, where the Colombian people are super supportive of the US, Japan, South Korea. You know, there's a lot of places around the world where there are very strong countries that do see us as the standard. And just because they weren't, you know, they weren't France and Germany, then we're told that we lost respect around the world.
Good. That's comforting.
Yes. I'm a little bit of an optimist on this stuff.
Yeah, I
love a grain of salt.
We need more of that. We need more optimism because woo.
Remember to follow me on the various platforms where you can find The Adrienne Ross Show. That's on YouTube, The Adrienne Ross Show. Be sure to like, subscribe, turn your notifications on. Also, check out my Substack, adrienneross.substack.com. Not only is The Adrienne Ross Show housed there, but my writing is there as well. Go to a podcast platform and be sure to subscribe and leave a rating and a review. And of course, I'm a part of the BMG Network. That is thebmgnetwork.com. Go to the BMG Network, check out the other podcasters, and follow them as well.
I want to start our conversation, this part of the conversation, with the newly elected president of Argentina. Now, you can correct any of my pronunciation of their name, but I believe it's Javier Milei. Okay. Eccentric looking guy. some are comparing to Donald Trump. I don't know if it's just the hair or what.
It's mostly the hair. And they like each other. So
yes. And you guys will be able to, if you're watching on YouTube and not just listening, if you don't know what he looks like, you can take a look at that now. But Trump and Milei, I've been hearing, you know, I've heard their names mentioned in the same sentence. I know the two of them met at CPAC for the first time. You did a piece called Make Argentina Great Again. Trump, Javier Milei hold first ever meeting. And you discussed that meeting and also how they have a history of speaking well of each other. He's spoken highly of Trump. Trump has spoken highly of him. Is there a real reason for this love affair, or is it just, you know, Trump loves to be loved? So starting there, what do you make of that connection between these two?
Well, I think Milei is first and foremost an economics nerd. I mean, he's a professor. He went to CPAC and he gave an hour-long speech citing Schumpeter and all these like obscure economists. And now you're going to get hate mail from the economists for me calling them obscure.
Right?
He's very much a book guy. And Trump is very much not a book guy. But Milei, through his studies, his book studies, and Trump, through his business experience and through his political experience, kind of arrive at the same place. I think their ideal of what a state should do and how a government should preside over its people is pretty in line, right? And so I think that's where they agree. And I think they also both have this element of whimsy to them and joy. Like, they campaign on joy. They, you know, Milei is out there with a chainsaw and like a Superman outfit, you know, liberty. I think anarcho-capitalist Superman is how he would dress up. So they're both guys who like to have fun, and they have a very similar economic approach. And they also have a similar approach regarding left-wing authoritarianism and communism. Milei refers to the whole thing as collectivism, and that's communism, socialism, all of it. And he basically is completely against it, and he'll, you know, he'll go on Argentine cable news and just blurt out profanities about the left openly.
I see the similarities.
yes, they're very crass. I mean, Milei has come out and said, you know, they're uglier than us, they're envious, they're scum, and that's how he won. And I think that's kind of why they like each other. I don't think that they're comparable in the sense of the United States and Argentina are not comparable. The history of the two countries is just not equivalent. And so you're not going to get guys that, you're not going to get political leaders that kind of see the world the same way. And for example, Milei is very pro-American exceptionalism. He thinks America should be the standard, like we were just talking about. And I think Trump is a little more hesitant to, he thinks that sometimes that is weaponized as a scam to get us to pay money for causes that are not our business, right? I don't think that he's in full, you know, the Tucker Carlson wing of, you know, America shouldn't be butting into every single international problem. I don't think he's all the way there, but he's definitely wary of when someone tries to use America's historical role in the world to ask for money. But that is a big difference between Milei and Trump. I think Milei would want to see a more assertive America and a more meddling America, for lack of a better word, than Trump would.
In that piece that I referenced, you started by saying Argentine president-elect, he was president-elect at the time, Javier Milei, won the nation's top office on November 19th by standing against many of the policies and values that define the administration of his American counterpart, Joe Biden, and presents a serious challenge to Biden's Latin America policy. Elaborate on that.
Well, Biden, for one, Biden is not really interested in Latin America. He went out of his way to not call a single Latin American president when he was elected himself, you know, to introduce himself as the president-elect. He's friendly with Lula in Brazil, who is a socialist convicted felon. But outside of that, he really just does not care. His attitude, even his Cuba policy, is pretty much the same as the Trump policy, because he hasn't even touched it. He just does not care. So I think a big problem that he's going to run into with Milei is that Milei does not want the sort of Biden negligence in Latin America. I think he, like I said, I think he wants a bigger role in America, helping, you know, countries that want to be self-sufficient, not just giving out charity, but actually helping with legitimate foreign investment and cracking down on Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua, who are allied again with Hezbollah, with drug cartels, with all these nefarious elements that make a free market impossible. And I don't think Biden's going to buy into that. And I think Biden is very put off by the Trumpiness of Milei also, just aesthetically. And you know, again, his profanity, his, you know, not that Biden is a stranger to profanity, but, you know, he doesn't want to be associated with that. And also, Biden is obsessed with climate stuff. Biden goes to everywhere. Anytime he talks to a foreign leader, he says two things. He says, we got to work on the Ukraine issue, and we have to stop the climate crisis. And Milei is actually very pro-Ukraine, but he's not pro-sending Argentine money to Ukraine. There is no Argentine money. The economy is broke. And he doesn't care about the climate crisis at all. He doesn't really believe that it is a priority. I don't want to put words in his mouth. It's possible that he believes that, you know, the earth is, you know, that there is some climate change, but he certainly doesn't think that it's an international emergency that needs to take priority over national sovereignty the way that I think Biden does.
All right. So let's transition to El Salvador, because I'm really fascinated with this. Nayib Bukele. Did I get that right?
Yep.
All right. So I want you to clear some stuff up. Okay. So he is, I want to say, the newly elected president, but he was elected, I believe, the first time in 2019.
Yes.
Okay. But he's just been reelected, I guess, contrary to El Salvador's constitution. And this is what I want, because I find this fascinating, even as an American, where people are talking about our constitution being under attack, et cetera. So this is why I find this extremely fascinating, and I think others will also. How in the world is Bukele able to be president again? I think you could serve one term, right? Is it 5 years?
Yeah, 5 years.
A 5-year term, and yet he's president for the second time, I think. Clear this up for us, please. What happened?
Sure. I'm very excited to get into nitty gritty comparative constitutional law. This is
okay.
So Bukele, what he did was essentially get rid of the entire Supreme Court, fired all the judges, put new judges in, and then those judges interpreted the Constitution to mean that what you can't do is begin a second term as you finish your first term. So they said, you got to step down for a few months. He stepped down, I think, in November, correct me if I'm wrong, but he stepped down a little bit before the election, had some, you know, his secretary or somebody be the president. And then he ran.
Oh, you mean like our president? No, that's...
but yeah, so that's what he did. He basically replaced the Supreme Court. And there's nothing illegal about him doing that, about saying, and his argument was these judges are corrupt. And, you know, he went to CPAC too, and he gave a very compelling speech where he said, you know, to us as Americans, it resonates, where he says, you know, the prosecutors weren't going after the criminals. The judges were letting them go. The judges were taking bribes. They were corrupt. And so he, in order to clean the country out of crime, it's not just taking the bad guys and putting them in jail, because the prosecutors will put them back on the street. The issue is getting rid of all the prosecutors, getting rid of all the judges, cleaning house, getting people in there who are incorruptible. And that's the argument that he used to kick out the entire Supreme Court and put a new Supreme Court in. But of course, it's very uncomfortable when the president gives all these people jobs, makes it very clear that he'll fire them as soon as he feels like it. And then a case comes to the court where they say, is the president allowed to continue being in office? And they all say yes, even though it very clearly says you cannot be reelected. And they just parsed the definition of reelection to mean, well, if he's not in office when the election happens, then he's not reelected.
So they play word games, really?
Yes. Well, that's all that law is.
Yeah. Okay. So, why? Like, why did people go along with this from Bukele?
Because he's a darn good president. And he did, I think he won that election fair and square. Essentially, what is happening in El Salvador is they had a huge civil war because of the communists again in the 80s. They have been ravished by crime, and they had these gangs that started emerging, MS-13, 18th Street. And we say gangs and we think kind of like young guys on a street corner playing dice. This is not what this is. This is guerrilla, like armed paramilitary groups that basically took over every aspect of life in El Salvador. People could not take their kids to the public park because the gangs would recruit the kid. People couldn't start a business to, you know, sell ice cream, an ice cream truck, because the gangs would immediately hit you up for an extortion fee. There was no aspect of life that the gangs did not control. And Bukele came in and he essentially empowered the government through a suspension of some constitutional rights, including, you know, freedom of assembly, so that the gangs couldn't meet up together, and arrested everybody. And he got some money from China, to build this mega prison, and he put all these people in jail. And I'm sure not every single person he put in jail was a member of a gang. I'm sure there were young men implicated in that were just, you know, collateral damage. But what the average Salvadoran would say, and you can even read this in, you know, El Faro, which is a Salvadoran newspaper that is very anti-Bukele, admitted that as of last year, you know, the gangs don't even exist. You could go to the park with your kid. You know, your freedom of assembly is technically limited by the state of emergency, but you can hang out with your friends at the park. And you couldn't do that when the Constitution wasn't temporarily suspended. And, you know, they had the Miss Universe pageant. They're going to have a huge esports gaming event. He's bringing back surfing tourism because El Salvador has gorgeous beaches. So he's doing a lot that makes the country a nicer place to live for the people who live there. And so a lot of Salvadorans are just not really, they don't want to think about right now if Bukele doesn't want to leave in 5 years, which is, you know, for me, as someone that studies this stuff for a living, I'm concerned about that. I don't know what he's going to do when the problem is solved and, you know, it's time to ride off into the sunset. And that worries me. But today, Salvadorans, they don't care. They just care that their kids aren't getting recruited by gangs.
Yeah, you know, because ultimately people want to know, how is this going to work for me? And and you know, there's a conversation now just about the shift in for Trump in the Black and Hispanic communities.
Yes.
And people are saying, why are we seeing this shift? And the bottom line is people realize that they were better under Trump. And we all want a better life. But I get concerned because I look at that, just as we talked about, how do these things affect us? I know America's a different place, but I do worry about America because I see a lot of lawfare going on, as we say. So are we looking at perhaps a time when we can all willy-nilly get rid of the Supreme Court? And you know, I mean, I was watching the State of the Union. Biden is threatening the Supreme Court sitting in front of him. And are we at a risk at all? Are we headed down a road where even if you're doing well, even if you're doing good things and you made life better, that our Constitution, our freedoms are in jeopardy in such a way?
Well, I don't know if this is good or bad news, but I think no matter what road we're on, we're always kind of 100 years away from that. 50 to 100 years away from that, a few generations of letting some things slide that are not exactly legally sound. That's the slippery slope. And we're always, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 years from that. But I think a big thing that is different with us is that the average American life for a lot of people, I don't want to say most people, but it's pretty stable. Like most Americans aren't dealing with just rampant gang violence, you know, where they can't go to the park. That exists in some parts of the country, but it's not, you know, it's not every part of the country like El Salvador was. You know, our civil war was a long time ago. It was not in the 1980s. So we don't have these kind of triggers that make it possible for leaders to just rampantly undo laws. And I think a big example of that is what's happening with Trump and the Colorado case where they tried to kick him off the ballot through the courts. Which is to me was very Brazil, you know, use the court to kick out the opposition. And what ended up happening was it goes to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court laughs it out of there 9-0, you know, even the quote unquote liberal judges. So I think that made me feel really good about my country. That made me feel like we are not there yet. We're not close to it, but we're always kind of close enough. Right. So we have to be very vigilant. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. This is why we watch other countries. This is why we study other countries, so that we can see the warning signs before they become so obvious that there's no turning around.
Absolutely. I mean, like I'm hearing, I mean, think about January 6th. There are people who are sitting in, you know, they're locked up. And there's video footage that they were escorted through. Daily Wire reporter who was picked up recently because he, like other reporters, went into the Capitol. There's Justin Trudeau, and the recent story about proposing locking up people for life for crimes that they may possibly commit down the line. I know you're, you know, I know you said you're speaking positively, and I know we have, you know, stronger safeguards, but I do think it's important to look at things like that because I don't feel
Absolutely.
the safety and the oh no, never here thing. I really don't, which is scary to me. And I don't even have children. I mean, I think about people like you have children. What kind of America are we going to have for them? I think is important to, is an important question to ask.
Yeah, and it's a scary feeling, but it's necessary. If we ever feel like it can't happen here, it's gonna happen here. And I go back to Venezuela. For years, Venezuelans, after they elected Hugo Chavez, because unlike Fidel Castro came to power in a coup. Hugo Chavez was democratically elected. And for years and years and years, you would hear Venezuelans tell Cubans, well, we're not Cuban. That could never happen here. You know, we're not like you. And there's a lot of resentment in the Cuban community about that. Like, we'll help them out, we'll get them jobs, but we won't let them forget that for years, a lot of Venezuelans said, we're not like you. We're not that stupid. We're not gonna, we have oil. You know, and look at Venezuela now, they're worse off than Cuba. So that feeling of it could happen here is very necessary, I think, to keep it moving forward. And that's, you know, it is scary, but we have to think about that and we have to look at those little things. I don't know the details of the January 6th cases, to be honest, but I think the spotlight needs to be on it so that, you know, everything is out in the open and nobody tries anything weird, right? And I think we also need to, again, look at other countries and see, especially the ones that are in the worst place, go backwards and kind of reassess where did this downhill start? And does it look like anything that we see in our country? And can we use that knowledge to fix the problem now before it becomes something bigger?
Absolutely. Let's transition to TikTok and China. Now, I heard you just the other day on Breitbart News Daily, and you were talking about the whole TikTok issue. I'm not a TikTok user, okay?
Me either.
Right. So are we overblowing the TikTok issue with China, or is China enough of a threat that we do need to ban this social media?
Well, I'm on the record calling for a full trade embargo with China. I think it's ridiculous that we have a trade embargo with Cuba, which has no businesses, and we don't have a trade embargo with China that is actively committing genocide and actively undermining our businesses and intellectual property theft, espionage, a million things. And that could be a whole other hour of talking. So I'll stop myself. But TikTok is a really big problem because we're giving this megaphone to a foreign adversary to speak to our children. And there's a big problem in this country. And I understand it. The way it starts is the economy is bad. People who are working class people, they're going to need to work more hours. They're going to need to work maybe multiple jobs. And they have kids, and somebody has to watch the kids. Somebody has to make sure the kids sit in one place so we can get our work done. And that's kind of where. That's the thing that TikTok exploits, right? So banning TikTok isn't going to fix that. But taking away the megaphone from the genocidal communists is obviously a good thing. And there are so many examples of TikTok amplifying just the most toxic, vile content to our youngest. And you know, one thing is our kids. There's also the politically active, you know, adolescents, 18 plus, that can vote, and they get their news from TikTok. That's absurd. That's not a situation that I think our country should allow.
Why such a pushback, though? Why such a resistance to banning TikTok? Is it just the First Amendment argument?
Well, there is no First Amendment argument because if you can't say something on the Chinese propaganda app, then you could just go out in the street and say it. You know, you can just go
Right.
on Twitter, go on Instagram, whatever.
But
There
that's what
is.
people, but that's what they're saying. Some are saying.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm arguing with the argument, not with you.
I'm with you.
But you know, I think it's TikTok is addictive, and what we're hearing is the outcry of addicts getting their drug taken away.
I think you're right. I think
Yeah,
you're right.
it's that's what it is. And TikTok itself put out a statement telling its users, go harass your congressman to not vote to ban us. And the thing is, it's not even a ban. The law says sell it to an American, you know, have it not be China owned, which means that you could keep having TikTok if you are a TikTok addict, but it just won't be owned and manipulated by the Chinese Communist Party. And something else that I forgot to mention before is the Chinese law requires Chinese companies to cooperate with its military and with its government, which means that every concern everybody has, and a lot of young people had, about Facebook, you know, taking information and giving it to the police or to the NSA, that goes times a thousand for a Chinese-owned application that is mandated by law to hand over all of its stuff to the government. And that government uses, you know, any sort of public display of anything that can be interpreted dissent as dissent to disappear people, to put them in camps, to put them in prisons, to torture them. And so if you're worried about Facebook taking your photos from 15 years ago in college and, you know, giving them to the NSA, you should be very worried about TikTok taking your stuff and giving it to the People's Liberation Army.
Wow. Wow. I would like to say I disagree with you about the addiction part, but I really think that's driving the resistance. And I hear a lot of conversation about the children, the young people, and that's important. But I would say that it's probably more adults, or just as many adults, who don't want their toy taken away either, even at the expense of the situation with China. And so I am really interested to see how this plays out. Like I said, I think I created a TikTok account somewhere now. I don't use it, but and when I was encouraged to use it because, you know, you could put this video out and you could advertise this way and you could do that and it would be really good. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna hold back on that. I don't know. All right. I would be remiss if I did not ask you about Russia and Putin. And I want to ask you, in the limited time you have left, what may seem like a strange question, but I'm really curious about it. I hear people saying that the American right, Republicans, sort of have this romance thing going with Putin. That there's this, you know, there's this idea somehow that he's not the evil man that he is. Where do you stand on Putin, and do you see any of that at all in our American politics?
I do see that. I don't think it's a Republican problem. I don't think it's a average conservative American problem. I think there is a sector of the internet that is that flirts with libertarianism, I guess. You know, the sort of the kind of people who take Thomas Massey seriously, and, you know, Thomas Massey votes for pro-China everything all the time, and then he says, I'm a libertarian, and everyone believes him. So yeah. That sector, which I think is a very small subset of the American right, I think that they've bought into the idea that, number one, that Putin is some sort of savior of Christians, that he protects Christians against radical Islam. And there's another slightly bigger concentric circle of people who are just fed up with giving money to Ukraine. And I don't think that they like Putin. I think that they just have reasonable complaints that they go to the grocery store and the eggs are $5. And then they hear that Zelensky's getting, you know, 500 million or whatever, and they're irritated. And I think those people, you know, most people are smart enough to understand that being annoyed by us giving money to a foreign lost cause that has nothing to do with us does not mean supporting the invasion. But there's probably a significant percentage of that population that might think, you know, maybe I should hear what Putin has to say. Maybe he's, you know, maybe he has a point, because I'm so fed up with the other side. And, you know, there was this weird transition period in 2022 between everybody who was obsessed with, like, vaccines and showing off their vaccines and hating Trump, and then they all put their Ukrainian flags on their profile pages, and that doesn't delegitimize the Ukrainian cause, but people who aren't, you know, spending all their time reading about international news probably equated all those things, and then they thought, you know, what if maybe Putin's not the bad guy here? I think anyone who takes 5 minutes to Google Putin would find out that Putin is in fact the bad guy here. Especially, you know, for us in the Hispanic community, Putin bankrolls Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. We are very clear on who he is. He is the one fueling this huge migrant flow. So I think we're kind of insulated from that. But does it exist? Yes. Is it, you know, every Republican loves Putin? No, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Here's the thought that we talked about. Well, I'll just put it this way. There's the thought and I hear the conversation that Putin did not invade Ukraine while Trump was in office. And a lot of people talk about that, talk about going back to the respect of America and the presidency. Is there any, is that valid? Is that a valid conversation to have?
Yeah, that's a fact. You know, Putin invaded Georgia in 2008 when George W. Bush was in Beijing, you know, slapping the butts of volleyball players. And you can look up the pictures. That's a real thing that happened while Putin was invading Georgia. Putin invaded Ukraine the first time in 2014. And this new invasion is just a continuation of an ongoing thing. There were Russian proxies fighting in Ukraine from 2014 to 2022. The only difference is that uniformed Russian soldiers went into Ukraine.
Let me ask it. Sorry to cut you off. Let me ask it more clearly. Did he not invade because Trump was in office? Which is what I hear.
I think that's fair. You know, I don't think I would say that that was the only consideration. And I don't think it was that he's scared of Trump as a human being. I think that Trump enacted policies that weakened Russia, weakened his allies, including things like just making oil cheaper. So we get cheaper gasoline and cheaper, you know, natural gas, and that weakens the Russian economy. And then Putin can't, you know, invade. So I wouldn't say directly Putin is scared of Trump. I just think Trump's policies created a world where it was not convenient for Putin to invade.
Wow. That's good. That's good. That's good. So we'll find out if we're going to make America great again soon enough. Before I let you go, who would you say is America's greatest geopolitical threat?
It's communism. And I know that's very vague, but I think it is Chinese communism because all of our elites are bought off. Everyone has some sort of economic stake in the Chinese economy. And that is bad because the Chinese government and Xi Jinping want to see us fall. They want to replace us as the superpower. And they're doing things to make that happen. And they're doing things, for example, legal, you know, we talked about illegal immigration from Latin America, the legal immigration and student visas that are given to the children of Chinese Communist Party elites to come here, to come to our universities and propagate, you know, the values and the agenda of the Communist Party. That's a problem. TikTok is a problem. just the fact that you can't even buy something new from a store and not be totally sure that a Uyghur slave made it. That's a problem. So I think almost every smaller problem that we see, it traces back to the Chinese Communist Party, and it traces back to that ideology, which is communism. And it's, you know, people will tell you China's not communist. It is. And I think that's, you know, and it's going to be our biggest adversary for the next 100 years. If China falls, somebody else will take up the mantle, unfortunately, but that's the nature of geopolitics. Mm.
Frances, you are so full of all kinds of information. I could just pick your brain. Thank you so much for taking your time.
Well, thank you.
No, I want people to be able to follow your work, to follow your writing, to follow you if you have a social media presence. Where can people keep up with what you're doing?
So on Breitbart.com, I run the Latin America, Africa, and I contribute to the Middle East page. So if you go to the world page and you see the different regions, you will probably find me in one of, if not all of those subset regions. And then I'm on Twitter at Frances Martel, Frances with an E. That's probably the most active place I am on social media. And I hope you guys keep reading because there's a lot of exciting and compelling stuff happening.
Good. And I'm going to make sure I put a link to your work in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really, really, really appreciate it. And we have to do it again.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I had a blast. That was a high wire act too. I was hoping it would all come out smart. I have great time, and I love the candor on your show. I love being able to talk on it. And I just feel really comfortable, and I'm really grateful for the platform.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate that conversation with Frances. I appreciate being able to pick her brain. She is a wealth of knowledge, and she is immersed in this every day. And I appreciate it especially because, as we said, we don't live in a bubble. We can't just say, that's what goes on over there. That has nothing to do with us. It has a lot to do with us or what could become of us. And so I'm grateful for the insight she shared. I'm going to make sure that I give you an opportunity to follow her work by putting her information in the show notes. Make sure you check it out and make sure you follow Frances Martell over at Breitbart News. So thank you so much for tuning in. But before I go, I want you to check out these important messages. Every car owner knows how important it is for the car to run properly. And it doesn't run properly if the transmission doesn't run properly. DL Transmissions is home of the free transmission inspection. Their free inspection includes a comprehensive road test with a top technician with state-of-the-art scanning equipment and a detailed consultation with Daryl LeGrand. If you think your transmission is not working right, call their office. It's 573-334-8726. Or stop by their shop at 783 South Kings Highway in Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
Search engines should be a place for you to discover the world and make your own decisions about what you find. That's why Luxel is improving your access to information. The new search engine eliminates search engine bias that gets in the way of your searches. You can filter results to lean right or left, and from there you can sort it by Luxel's algorithm, alphabetically, and by freshness. Plus, there is no price for privacy. Luxel is free and doesn't track you or sell your data. So check out Luxel. That's LUXXLE.com and take control of your searches.
Guardians of Liberty is a nonpartisan, community-based grassroots organization that functions as a liberty focus group at the local level, while also keeping our eyes on the original intent of the United States Constitution as written by our founders. Every Tuesday at 5 o'clock p.m. at Delmonico's in Jackson, there's something to be learned. On March 19th, L. Douglas Hogan will be there discussing Agenda 2030 and healthcare. And then on March 26th, Dr. Kenneth Haskin, Cape Girardeau City Manager, will be there discussing 2024 Cape City Agenda. Check it out. Guardians of Liberty, proclaiming liberty throughout all the land. All right, that does it for this episode of The Adrienne Ross Show. God willing, I'll catch you next time. God bless you abundantly.